From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. And for the first time on our show, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you.
We hope to see you here a lot. And here are the issues. In a special election in which President Trump's standing was at stake, Republican Karen Handel defeated Democrat John Ossoff. More than $50 million was spent in the campaign, making it the costliest election of a member of the House of Representatives ever. In the Senate, Republicans unveiled a health care plan to replace the one sponsored by President Obama and enacted in 2010. In Washington, a former Homeland Security official said Russia, and Vladimir Putin in particular, had targeted voting systems in 21 states during last year's election in the United States. And in Saudi Arabia, King Salman pushed aside the heir apparent to the crown and named his 31-year-old son as crown prince. Well, I'm going to start with you, Paul, since you're here for the first time. The election in Georgia, it sort of got out of hand the way it was treated by the press, as if this was, you know, the biggest thing that had happened in a long time politically.
I don't think anybody should have been surprised, Fred, that Karen Handel won this race. This has been a Republican district since, I think, 1979. Mm-hmm. And it was won back in November by 23 points. By the current HHS Secretary, of course, Tom Price. So with that kind of margin, that kind of track record, you know, why would anyone think that Joel Ossoff, this 30-year-old who didn't even live there, by the way, had a chance of winning? What was interesting, though, was the fact that the margin was nowhere near 23 points. I mean, it was what, about
four points.
Four or five.
Less than 4 points.
So that's kind of an interesting trend. Nobody, I didn't think he would really win, but the fact that he cut into the Republican margin there, I think, is kind of an interesting data point.
Well, so many Democrats got awfully excited about his chances of winning. He's 30 years old, an attractive candidate. I didn't understand why he didn't just rent an apartment in the district and register there. But anyway, what's your take, Barbara?
Yeah, well, you know, every one of these things becomes a sort of battle of the century, right? So I think it was hyped. But certainly the amount of money was totally unprecedented. The fact that he did as well as he did, I think, is important. And there was another special election on the same day, which actually people had paid very little attention to. This was in South Carolina. Archie Parnell, also a first-time candidate, almost pulled off a huge upset for the seat vacated by another Trump cabinet member, Mick Mulvaney, the budget director. Parnell lost by only 2,800 votes to the Republican. So, you know, I think that obviously Democrats were disappointed. That it would have been amazing if they'd been able to pick up a seat in a place like this district in Georgia that had historically gone Republican. But if I were a Republican, I wouldn't, you know, relax. I think there's a lot that Republicans have to worry about for the upcoming midterm elections.
You know, these special elections, which I've sort of been following for many years, they tend to be very close because there's not an incumbent. And obviously, Tom Price, if he were running again, he'd win easily in the district. But this was Karen Handel, who was obviously not the incumbent. And she spent a lot of money, too. But I think that's part of the reason why they got so much attention. There was all this money spent.
Sure. And ads.
In behalf and ads and so on. Ultimately, the Republicans spent a lot of money, too, but not as much as was spent for John Ossoff. You know, this was the fourth straight special election in which Republicans in Republican seats and Democrats had not won any of them. This is a little different because it was a district that's different. You know, Donald Trump and Republicans don't do as well among college graduates as Democrats do. And this is a very college graduate heavy district. I think it's the most Republican held district in the country with the percentage of college graduates. Now, that on the other hand, it is Georgia. and I think people miss some of the things that this
And Karen Handel was a state official. She was well known.
She was very well known. She'd run before. She'd run for governor unsuccessfully, and she'd run for the Senate unsuccessfully. So she was she was hardly an unknown. But there's some things this is not. I mean, you know, we over the years, it's been discovered that these special elections are not predictive. The press has often treated them as, gee, if this happens, whoever wins one of these special elections like this, they'll win. More than a year later, they will win in the midterm election. That's never been the case. They're not. They're just simply not predictive. And another thing is, which an official of the Republican House Campaign Committee told me, is that has no effect on whether President Trump might be impeached or not. That's,
sure.
I mean, these elections don't affect that at all. But my question is, let me ask you, Paul, why did it get so much attention? I mean, was this just sort of the media got out of hand in covering it or what?
Oh, the media never gets out of hand, Fred. I look, they're attracted to a bright, shiny objects and a drama and, you know, and that's what we had here. But again, at the end of the day, you keep coming back to the historical data here. I mean, this is a Republican district. It's about as red as it gets.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, it's quite, well, it's not Idaho.
It's pretty red,
like
yes.
It's quite red, not as,
you know,
quite
in,
as red.
In
as
case
it.
You don't understand what Paul is saying, red means a Republican and blue means Democratic.
Conservative.
And you're correct.
Well,
and
also, almost won in the sort of scramble, was it the primaries? The first round. This was the second round. This was a runoff.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was part of it, too, that he did so well. He almost won.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, if you look at history, in the past 39 midterm elections, these are the elections we have between our big presidential elections, in most of those, the party that is not in the White House, 36 of the last 39 times, has lost seats. So I think it's not unreasonable to say that the Democrats are going to gain some seats next year.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fair, but the question is, you know, how many? And to make predictions right now, a year and a half away, is silly because we don't know, for example, what the economy is going to be like and all these other variables. So predictions are just kind of useless, I think.
I want to raise one other thing here because it may be entirely unfair, but because Democrats lost this House race, the Democratic leader in the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi of California, has been attacked by younger members of her party and said, we need a new leader of our party in the House. One, is this fair? Or two, and two, is it a good idea? I mean, they do have, particularly in the House, a pretty aging leadership, Barbara.
Yeah, look, you know, it's for the House Democrats to decide.
I know, but one, we can
one
have
of
opinions.
one of the techniques that they used against Joel Ossoff was they tied her to Nancy Pelosi, and she is a polarizing figure in a lot of places, and so that was very effective. If they were a younger, perhaps more centrist sort of figure, although some actually are calling for a more left-wing leadership, and going more to the Bernie Sanders wing of the party as a way to revive the Democrats. But we have a long time before the midterms, and the Democrats will sort it out. And Nancy Pelosi seems to enjoy her job, and she doesn't show any sign of stepping aside. She's 75, but
77.
No, I think she's 75.
Well,
but
okay.
Donald Trump,
she's in her mid to late 70s.
She's in her mid 70s. Let's put it that way.
But she looks great,
she
and
does.
Donald Trump is 71. So I don't think the Republicans have anything to talk about. Also, Mitch McConnell is not exactly.
And, well, it's not Republicans who are complaining about
the fountain
of
youth
leadership.
There. So I mean, there are a lot of old people on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Look, Nancy Pelosi has been an extremely effective leader. If
she
you
has.
Hear her at a press conference, she doesn't sound particularly convincing, but
behind the scenes,
she's behind the scenes.
She's
tough and has done a great job, and is, I think she's not about to step down, and I don't think they're about to force her to step down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I belabored this subject because I guess I'm abnormally interested in it.
And happy about it.
Well, as you all seem to say, it was kind of expected.
We'll give you a victory, Fred. You don't get many.
Am I getting a victory here? Okay. Let's turn to this health care plan that Republicans unveiled in the Senate that would replace Obamacare, or they call it a draft. And I talked to a couple of senators yesterterday, and they say, well, it's a draft. It's going to have to change a lot before they actually have a vote on it, maybe sometime next week. Paul, what'd you make of it?
Well, you know, for people who are wondering, you know, what the difference is between, the House of Representatives a couple of months ago passed its version, which, of course, went nowhere in the Senate. But there's a Senate version is actually, when you look at it, it's not exactly that different. I mean, it involves big tax cuts for the rich and eventually cutting off Medicaid, maybe at a different speed. But at the end of the day, those are sort of the two big things here.
There's one more, though, and it kills the requirement for all Americans to buy health insurance.
Well, I remember two out of three. But the
That's pretty good.
But the problem is for Mitch McConnell, of course, the Senate majority leader, is that he can only, if you look at, the composition in the Senate, they have 52 votes. He can only afford to lose two of them. And earlier this week, there were four Republican senators who said, well, we're not quite ready to vote for it, meaning, mm-hmm. You've got to put something else on the table here. So this is nowhere near a done deal yet. So there are some Republicans to the right, the far right, who say this doesn't go far enough. And then you have some centrist Republicans in the Senate who say, well, perhaps it goes too far. So in between, you've got McConnell trying to play both ends here. Mm-hmm. And boy, he's a skilled parliamentarian. But boy, how he's going to kind of manage that is that's anybody's guess.
Barbara?
I would agree with what Paul said. I think it's particularly hard on the poor, on the elderly. It's not something that's going to be terrifically popular, even among people who voted for Trump. But it's something that the Republicans have promised. It's something that Trump promised. And so he has to sort of check that box. There are even reports that if it doesn't survive in the Senate, Mitch McConnell will simply say, well, we tried and go on. But the removal of the individual mandate is a very serious thing because that undermines basically the whole premise of the healthcare system. If you can't oblige young, healthy people to pay for insurance, you're not going to be able to finance the benefits for those who are older and sicker.
And of course, all this was accompanied by some kind of terrible pictures of parents wheeling their disabled children around who really do need care, no question about it. And some of them were ejected from Capitol Hill and things like that. Very embarrassing pictures here. And I think it's reasonable to say that, look, those folks have to be addressed at some point. And cutting them off slowly, as this bill suggests, or the House bill, which is kind of an immediate cutoff, that's not satisfactory to anyone, I don't think. And also, Trump promised that he would protect Medicaid. And of course, that's simply not true.
Medicaid
in these
too.
Bills.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to argue about that, but I would say this. Republicans have a problem with health care. It's just not an issue that they've ever been good at handling. That's their issue. They're very good at that. But health care has been one that they have stumbled on, and they may still be stumbling. Anyway, we're going to have to take a break here. As I remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show are Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. And this is a reminder, you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for a free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Before I move on, Paul, what does West Wing Reports do besides report on, maybe that's the only thing, on the White House?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. It's a White House-based news service, and I have television clients and radio clients across the United States, but also overseas, and I write columns for American newspapers and a couple of books mostly dealing with White House and presidential history, and I speak at a lot of presidential libraries, six or seven so far, and that kind of thing. So it's really just a privilege to be able to come on and talk about all of these sorts of issues.
Good. Good. Well, let's talk about Saudi Arabia. Barbara, should we have been surprised? I mean, I was, but I don't know that much about Saudi Arabia, that King Salman shoved aside the guy who was the crown prince, and I'm sure he was expecting to become the king, and naming his son, very young, 31, I believe, in that position. What's going on here?
Yeah. No, you shouldn't be surprised. I mean, this has been coming basically since the death of King Abdullah and the accession of King Salman. It was very clear that Mohammed bin Salman, his now 31-year-old son, was being groomed to take the throne. He pushed aside a more experienced gentleman, Mohammed bin Nayef, who had been the interior minister and in charge of counterterrorism Saudi Arabia, someone that the United States had known well and worked with for a long time. It's a little worrisome on a number of levels. Basically, Mohammed bin Salman has been calling the shots for the last couple of years. And some of the decisions that he's made have been disastrous. Saudi Arabia is embroiled in a war in Yemen. Thousands have died. 7 million people are on the brink of starvation. Cholera has broken out. All of this in an attempt to get rid of a bunch of rebels that come from a group known as the Houthis, mm-hmm. And to reinstall the very unpopular president of Yemen. It doesn't seem as though the Saudi campaign has been making any headway. The Houthis are still entrenched in the capital, Sana'a. And the country was already very poor, and now it's really, it's a completely failed state. The only beneficiary of this campaign has been Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based in Yemen. So that was number one. Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's known, is the defense minister also of Saudi Arabia. Number two is what's called...
Do they answer to that? say... MBS.
MBS. No, it's what response. We call. It's what we call. Number two is.
It goes by Sir.
Sir MBS. Number two is Vision 2030, which is this very ambitious plan to reform the Saudi economy, diversify it so it's not entirely dependent on oil, et cetera, et cetera. And there are very mixed reports about how well that's going. I mean, Saudi Arabia, believe it or not, is going to have to start importing oil if it doesn't do things like reduce the subsidies for electricity and so on. Anyway, jury's out on that. And then number three is Qatar. You know, recently Saudi Arabia, MBS and MBZ, that's Mohammed bin Zayed, the crown prince in the United Arab Emirates, got together to gang up on little Qatar. And they have now put a blockade on this little piece of land that sticks up like a thumb off the coast of Saudi Arabia, trying to force it to do a number of things. They have 13 demands, including shutting down Al Jazeera, the very popular Arabic television station that comes out of Qatar. And, you know, all it's done so far is push Qatar into the arms of Turkey and Iran. So, you know, so far I think MBS is 3-for-3, and it's not a good prospect. And this guy will be the king. I expect that his father will abdicate very soon, and
really?
And MBS will formally be installed as the king.
You know, Paul, somebody wrote, I forget who it is, saying, you know, this is one of the rare times when, if you read the actuarial charts anyway, here this young man could be in power for 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's another country where you can look ahead and say, you know, somebody's going to be in charge for that long. Anyway, what's your take?
Well, the king is 81, so I think there's no question that, you know, he's...
And he has dementia.
So there's no question he's a short timer. He's 81. Yeah. I didn't know about the dementia. But, you know, and his son is 31. But, you know, to your point, the thing that I worry about, or wonder about, at least in Saudi Arabia, is these economic reforms. These Saudis have always had this gravy train for a long time. Free pensions, free health care, free university. No taxes, you know, no utility bills, on and on and on. Boy, it sounds, you know, great. But all of that has always been paid for by oil. And the price of oil, of course, as everybody knows, has plunged over the last couple of years. So they are really feeling the economic pinch here. And that's why we have this trouble. And the problem demographically in Saudi Arabia is that the bulk of the population there is young, under the age of 24, I think half the population. And they're used to all these handouts and not working and importing, you know, all the hired help they need and everything. Well, all of that is slowly going away. And people, I think, could possibly get restless. I've sort of read an analysis by sort of our central intelligence agency. They worry about just how stable is the Saudi government. Who knows? I mean, if you start taking things away from the people, boy, that's how trouble starts.
Let me add one more thing, and that is typically, you know, the founder of Saudi Arabia had a number of sons, some enormous number. Most of them are dead now. But typically, they alternated power between the different sort of branches, the different lines coming from, you know, the different sons, right? And to have a direct father-son accession to the throne is unprecedented in Saudi Arabia, not to switch to another branch of the family. So there are 15,000 princes in Saudi Arabia. I am sure some of them are very annoyed that King Salman has decided that his son will take over for him and not, you know, the son of another one of the sons of Ibn Saud. This is going to cause a lot of problems. Again, I mean, just simply parceling out the goodies within the royal family. That's a good question. I mean, there was a pledge of loyalty to the new crown prince. Everyone dutifully signed off on it. But you can be sure that behind the scenes there is grumbling. Mm-hmm. And if they have to start cutting back on these very generous allowances that go to all these 15,000 princes and their families, I think there'll be more grumbling.
Does this signify identify any change in policy on the part of Saudi Arabia or not, Barbara?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman has been in charge for the last couple of years, essentially. What's also striking, and Fred, I'm sure you remember that in the past, Saudi foreign policy in particular was very cautious.
Indeed.
You know, everything was done behind the scenes, and usually with money, the Saudis would pay off this one or pay off that one. This kind of aggressive, you know, for example, going against a fellow member of the Gulf Cooperation Council like Qatar in this very rough way, this is unheard of. So it's the sort of thing that a 31-year-old might do, but an 81-year-old would not. And I think, you know, a lot of people are still kind of in shock because we remember King Abdullah, you know, who was very seasoned, and before him, King Fahd. These were seasoned individuals who, you know, they had the same foreign minister for 40 years. So it's taking some getting used to. And the Trump administration is trying to embrace him. He seems to be very popular, MBS, with Jared Kushner. So, you know, maybe that will help him.
Jared Kushner is, of course, Donald Trump's son-in-law. Last issue, the testimony from the former Homeland Security Secretary, Jay Johnson, was that Vladimir Putin had targeted 21 states, their voting systems, for hacking during last year's presidential election. We know from testimony by the former FBI director, James Comey, that they didn't succeed. But this is, you talk about aggressive. I mean, this really is an aggressive effort against the United States by Vladimir Putin.
Well, what's amazing is that all this focus, Fred, on collusion or alleged collusion between Trump and the Russians, that's the real story, is what the Russians have done to us. Now, the fact that, you know, these attempts to hack into our election systems weren't overly successful, that's not the point. The point is that they're trying to do this, and I think they're certainly only going to get better. What are we doing about it? To me, that is the central issue. So all of Washington is so concerned of the drama, what was Trump's involvement with this or that. Okay, that's interesting. But again, the broader issue is a foreign country trying to interfere in our most sacred ritual, how we elect our leaders. That's just a tremendous story here. We're not paying enough attention to that.
Barbara?
I caught some of Jay Johnson's testimony, and there were some questions about how easy it would be to hack into these systems. And apparently, you know, when they're online and they're downloading sort of software upgrades or something like that, a lot of these systems would be vulnerable to some sort of tampering, and the Russians are really, really good at it.
And they're only going to get better.
And they're only going to get better. You know, the fact that President Trump still can't seem to admit that the Russians tampered with our elections. I mean, he still has not been able to bring himself, in between commas, occasionally, well, maybe. I mean, he still seems to think it was some, you know, what did he say, 400-pound guy sitting on his bed.
I had a feeling you were going to bring up President Trump.
is really distressing. If you don't acknowledge the problem, how can you possibly fix it? Yeah, I think we should be very concerned. There's no evidence that the actual vote totals were altered by the hacking, but it wasn't for lack of trying.
Paul, let me ask you this. Am I wrong in thinking that while Russians have been doing a lot of this stuff toward the United States for a long time, their efforts have gotten much bigger, grandiose, and trying to hack an election?
Well, we've seen what they've done, and it's not just the United States. I mean, there's evidence they tried to interfere with this recent election in France, I think, and other places. I mean, clearly, it looks like their strategy is, if not to undermine our electoral system, at least to, you know, plant these seeds of distrust and get us to argue with each other and everything. And boy, from that standpoint, looks like they've succeeded.
I don't know. We argue pretty
How
much
about
with
that?
Here without prodding.
That's
but
true.
Is that true? Have the Russians gotten worse?
Yes, they have.
This?
And the other aspect, of course, is the fake news and the trolls, the bots, all these computer-generated creatures that spread malicious nonsense.
What are the trolls?
I've
never been clear about
that.
Well,
Fred, for that, you have to get on Twitter. If you get on Twitter or Facebook, for that matter, what they do is they will come out and attack you personally, often for something that you have posted, put something out there that's completely crazy, but then because of the way computers work, they can get a number of retweets or shares of the items so that it kind of spreads like a malignant cancer all over, you know, these various social media sites, and people will be exposed to them. And, of course, those who have less of a firm grasp on reality may be influenced by them and may believe them and spread them, especially if it caters to their own particular conspiracy theories.
Well, those, you know, it seems like those who haven't got a good grasp of reality are all over the Internet.
Unfortunately.
Anyway, there are a few of them.
Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports. This program was produced by Yanya Zalewski. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.